Welcome to Sophisticated Property Investing, a podcast brought to you by Ethical Property Partners, the experts in sophisticated property investment.
And welcome, ladies and gents, to our next episode of the Ethical Property Partner podcast, Sophisticated Property Investing. And I'm delighted to introduce you to a new friend of mine, Reid Goossens. Welcome, sir.
G'day, mate. Thanks for having me.
You guys might have already picked up on the Australian accent, but that's a bit of a red herring because Reid is actually based in the US and has been for some time and is a bit of an expert on the real estate market in the United States. So, Reid, thank you for coming on the podcast. I know I've been on yours recently, and thank you for repaying the favor. But I think our listeners are in for a treat, mate, with your perspective on sophisticated real estate investing. So can you take us back just for our information to when you first started investing in property? What attracted you to it? What were your first steps, etc.?
My background is actually in structural engineering, and I graduated in 07, and I headed to your neck of the woods. I was in London for a year and a half, working on the 2012 Olympic Games, but in 2008 working on Paddington Station. And then the reason I'm just sort of setting the stage of my background, because the year after I left London, I actually went to the south of France and I worked on the super yachts down there. And during that time, I met my then girlfriend, now wife, Erica, and she is American. So we kept in contact, and I spent 2009, I was spent some time on super yachts in the south of France. And then, you know, end of 2009, I crossed the Atlantic Ocean on this yacht, and I was in the Caribbean, and I just, you know, I enjoyed the time abroad, but I wanted to, you know, get back and, you know, no offense to anyone who's listening who's on a super yacht, to use my brain a little bit more, not just be the hired help. And that's when I backpacked through the United States, and I really fell in love with New York City. I backpacked through LA, which was where I live now. This is where Erica's from. And it was just like, I need to live in the US at some point. And so I go back to Australia in 2010, I'm back in a cubicle, and I just had these incredible 2 years of gallivanting around the world and a fall in love with this American girl and blah, blah, blah. And I just knew that I had more to give in life than sitting in a cubicle. And so the question you ask is, when did I get started? I actually got started by picking up the book Rich Dad Poor Dad. And that was in 2010. That was exactly what I wanted to hear and read at the time, because I had no idea what an entrepreneur was. I just knew that I was a small cog in a big, you know, corporation, being a structural engineer. But it also helped me realize that, hey, there's ways that I can go out and become someone to pay me to live my life. That's what I wanted someone to do, right? I want to continue traveling and continue surfing and do all the cool things. And all of a sudden, real estate, just like, it was the aha moment. It clicked. It was the penny dropped for me. And that's when I started the journey of learning. And I started to scratch the surface of wanting to be a real estate investor. And I started going to a few events in Australia. But ultimately, at the end of 2011, I had an opportunity to move to the US and chase this girl. And I said, screw it, let's go. Let's move to New York City. I want to be an expat in New York City. And as soon as I landed here, I landed in the US. Within 2 weeks, fresh off the boat, I was at my first real estate investment meetup. You know, it's in New York City. It's literally taking information out of a fire hose. It's the Big Apple. And there's 300 other investors there, all fast-talking Americans. And I'd been used to sort of, you know, 30 or 40 people at a meetup in Brisbane, Australia, for talking about property. This was literally on steroids. And I quickly realized the access to information here was just incredible compared to where I was from in Australia. And soon, like through these learning, you know, courses and stuff like that I was doing, reading books and, you know, stuff that was, I would have to pay tens of thousands of dollars in Australia at the time, was readily available at these weekend boot camps that I'd pay $20 at the door to go to. And so it was this incredible opportunity to, like, oh my gosh, wow, this is awesome. And my sort of superpower is that I had this rose-tinted glasses on the fact that I had this outsider perspective on the US market. I then quickly realized that the barriers to entry here in certain cities, and I'm talking about secondary and tertiary markets, so not LA, not San Francisco, not New York, but there's these other markets like the Texases and the North Carolinas and this sort of stuff where there's really quite affordable properties. And I bought my first property in the middle of 2012. I was 6 months fresh off the boat. No one was lending to me. I didn't know what a credit score was. I had to use my own cash, and I bought my first property for $38,000 in upstate New York, which was a place called Syracuse, New York. And the reason I chose there was the fact I could get on a Greyhound bus at Penn Station and I could be up there in 4 hours, you know, tour a few properties, get back on the bus and come back down and be back in New York City for some drinks with the boys, you know, on a Saturday night. So that was the start. So it was a bit of a convoluted, you know, introduction, but I needed to lay the platform for you to understand the journey of coming to the US and really the education that I took to get to the point of getting that first property. Because I will say, for all your listeners out there, I spent about 2.5 years, from the time I picked up Rich Dad Poor Dad to the time I actually bought that first property, it's about 2.5 years of education. So I spent a lot of time learning about the craft of real estate and just knowing that I got to a point where I knew that if I didn't get off the starting block, if I don't get the first deal done, I won't get to deal number 10. And so that was really important for me. And I got to the point of the analysis paralysis. And that's what ultimately led me down the path of buying my first little property for $38,000. So, yeah.
Amazing, isn't it? Just 10 years ago, 38K. Yeah, unbelievable. And from that point, Reed, how's the last 9-10 years gone for you? Tell us.
Let's fast forward to what I do today.
Yeah.
I am the founder of two companies. One is Wildhorn Capital, which is a syndication company based in Central Texas. And we have about $450 million of assets under management today. We have about 3,000 multifamily apartment units. And we can get into what that means in a little bit. But I've achieved financial freedom along the way. It's been a lot of ups and downs. There's been a lot of sleepless nights, a lot of, you know, big days. I've also started my own podcast called Investing in the US, which I started that many, many years ago to sort of educate people about the benefits of investing here. I've written a couple of books and, hopefully I've kept my feet on the ground along that process. So it's been an incredible time. But, looking back, it's also been something that I never thought I was going to do when I first moved to the US. I moved to the US just to be an expat, right? I was just going to move here, try and chase a girl, and then if it didn't work out, I'd move home. 10 years later, I'm sitting here on a podcast talking to you about all these units and financial freedom, and it's absolutely incredible. Well, my whole stick is when I go on other people's podcasts, and I know yours is based in the UK, but it is really, but if an Aussie can move halfway around the world and achieve financial freedom, why can't the average American? So
yeah, absolutely. Although I do think it does. In many ways, it will have hindered you, of course, you know, credit score, parents not being in the US, you know, guarantors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But probably from that perspective of having a different paradigm on the opportunities there and a different slant on the way things might work probably gave you a bit of an edge. So awesome. Plus, of course, sound a bit different. I'm sure that hindered you in some ways. But I've worked in the US quite a bit. I worked there for 4 years on and off, and North Carolina, funnily enough. I found that some people are like, oh, you're a Brit, come chat to us. You know, I'm sure it's the same as an Aussie. And, yeah. And others is like, yeah, whatever, you know. So talk us through that journey in a bit more detail, Reed, because that's, sure. That's what I'm interested in. A lot of our listeners are global, predominantly UK, US and Australia, funnily enough. So we're hitting all three bases tonight. And I say tonight because it's like 9 p.m. here and like noon for you, 1 p.m. there for you. So you got the better deal on the time zone arrangements, I tell you.
Thank you.
Your PA is more persuasive than mine, clearly. And so a lot of our listeners, wherever they're based, will have done a deal, maybe even, you know, if they're in a 9-to-5 that pays pretty well, maybe even 5 or 10 deals over a number of years. And really want to quit the 9-to-5 like you did. They'll want to go full-time in property, perhaps are quite happy to work 20, 40 hours a week in their property business, but have the luxury of control over their time, control of their location, etc., and gradually move to a very comfortable retirement. They will be looking at that story going, well, how do I cross the chasm in between? Yes, I can go and buy, you know, in today's money in the UK, a 60 grand house or an 80 grand house. But how do I get from that to earning 100K a year and quit my day job? So can you talk us through how you achieved that, please, Reed?
Yeah, look, and it's a long, between the point of picking up Rich Dad Poor Dad, the book in 2010, to leaving my day job, and I'll remind the listeners, I also had visa problems. Like I needed to stay in the States, I needed to have a job. it took me 8 years to get to quit the day job. And now I will say along the way, I did some things that looking back were quite smart, but in the process, it wasn't something that I was probably as conscious about the decision-making process. So one of the stories I talk about a lot is when I first moved to the US, the day working experience that I got from working on the super yachts, where I'd literally rock up to the docks and you'd go to boat to boat to boat to boat. Hey, you got any day work? No, 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 no. And then one person would eventually say yes, and you'd get fed for the day and whatever. And that was in 2009. I used the same strategy actually when I moved to New York, but I was doing it with structural engineering firms. And I walk around all these firms, no, 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 no. And then someone said, yes, that got me the visa. Engineering was just, that was a stepping stone, right? And it was the job that got me to stay in the UK, in the US, right? I could stay with my girlfriend and we could continue our relationship. I could get the Australian visa, which was really quite lucrative at the time. And then when we moved to LA from New York in 2014, I did the same process, got another job, literally walking in, just knocking on the door, hey, I'm here, give me a job, someone gave me a job, got the visa. And then I got to a point where I was like, look, I'm so enthralled with real estate. I'd done a few deals on the side. I bought a couple of properties in upstate New York. I was flipping a house from afar in Philadelphia, but I was living in LA with a business partner. I'd got my own real estate coach at that point. I was really focused on moving into the biggest game, the multifamily, the commercial assets. But then I realized, like, look, if I still got to be in a day job for the next couple of years, what skills do I have that I could be transferable to? And I really, I'm a structural engineer. I'm project management. I know how to build things from the ground up. And coincidentally, I was working at a structural engineering firm that was the structural engineer for a couple of developers in LA that were building multifamily. And I was like, well, I'm just going to give this a go. I'm just going to email these guys, see what they say. And that was, someone got back to me. And coincidentally, my wife is actually Jewish, and the guy, my boss at the time, he is Jewish, but his wife was Australian. So it was a little the opposite way. And he was just like, you got a great story. I love your work ethic. And yeah, we'll give you a job. And that was a real pivoting point, among a lot of other things. But when people look at jumping that chasm, I was doing deals on the side. And I continued to do deals on the side, but I also looked at how could I be paid my maximum, what we call a W-2. W-2 means you're a J-O-B here in the States. Hmm. What's the biggest corporate level job I could get, still being paid well, still learning, and see how the big boys do it, and then still applying those skills on the side. And for all your listeners out there, there's so many, you are all standing on a mountain of value. You just got to understand what that is so you can go, maybe if you have to stay in a day job, use it to your benefit to continue growing your skills so you can then apply it in your own portfolio, even if you have to keep, because we've got to keep roof overhead, we're all going to keep the missus happy, we're all going to keep food on the table. That story there is just a little bit of an insight of my journey. And I ultimately was with that company for four and a half years building a couple of hundred high-end luxury multifamily apartments in Long Beach before I was able to get my green card and then jump off into the day. And at that point, I'd already syndicated, I think, nearly 1,000 units. Probably about 600 units in Central Texas. So I was doing deals on the side, and then I got to a point where I was like, "This business is going to blow up, and I need to." I was spending too much time in the day job, and that was actually hindering the growth of my own business at that point. So then it was an easy decision to say, "Look, I'm out of here." So, yeah.
Awesome. When you say syndicate, that might be lost in translation.
Sure.
But what do you mean by that? I'm going to have a punt at that. I think what you mean is putting together deals with multiple investors, building from the ground up with JV finance. Is that where you're coming from with syndicate?
Yeah, no, not building from the ground up, but buying existing assets, buying existing multifamily assets, typically 150, 200 units. And it's one property. And the thing and I don't know about the UK, but I know in Australia, there is not, we don't have the asset class of multifamily on the large scale you have here in the United States. So think of an apartment building in UK, right? I'm coming in and buying all the entire block, right? The financing is on the entire thing. I go raise money from my investors. They help with the down payment. And then we go in and we do a value add strategy, which is we come in and we renovate units. And then we know that the in-place rents are compressed compared to where the market is. We increase those as tenants move out, we renovate, and we slowly go through the entire property over a period of 3 or 4 years. Mm. We also increase, you know, we change the leasing center, we add amenities, we add, you know, gyms, and you know, we may rebrand the property, and ultimately we're increasing the net operating income, right, the NOI. And that NOI increase does two things. It increases the cash flow, but it also increases the value of the asset, right? Because it's in the US, multifamily is judged like a business. So if you increase that NOI and your market cap rate stays roughly the same or even compresses, depending on where you are on the market, then the value of that asset goes up because you've increased the revenue. Mm. We're not all sitting on a mountain of cash. You know, we had to go, it's OPM, other people's money, and raising money from investors, you know, because it's really a relationship of I'm the business owner who can go out and find great deals. And investors may not have the time or the energy, but they understand the benefits of real estate investing, but they, you know, just can't go off and execute on a large deal like we're finding. And it's a combination of ultimate leverage. We leverage them, they leverage us, and we go off and buy these assets. And we buy one property at a time because one property might have 250 units on it. Another property might have 100 units. And so over the past 5 or 6 years, we've amassed about 14 assets in a totality of about 3,000 units, about $450 million total worth of the portfolio today.
And you're holding those at the moment, Reid. The business strategy is to buy at current value, to add value, and then refinance out. So you're basically, even your investors are left with no money left in. Is that the basic strategy?
Yeah, right? we as an organization, I typically hold periods 4 to 5 years. We will always come to a sale. It's, in theory, it's nice to refi. But typically, if you're putting 25% down on these large properties, you've really got to increase that value a lot to refi everyone out. Also, I don't want to have to be forced, and this is just my perspective. I don't want to, if the deal can stand alone, we can buy it in year one and sell it in year five, and investors make a great bunch of money.
It's not a long time, is it? Yeah.
It's not a long time. Yeah. And if we don't refi, right, because refiing also juices the returns. And if I don't, and if the deal can just stand alone without a refi, then the numbers are still really, really good. Then boom, knowing that a refi is always up my sleeve, right? If something happens in the market, or you know,
help for another three or four years, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And also, you've got the work involved in refinancing and the cost, and of course, both of those can really hamper the growth on other deals, can't they? So that makes sense. There's a bit of a bubble, I would say, in the UK at the moment. It's full of hot air. It's the whole joint venture. We have a bit of a bubble in the UK housing market as well, but put that to one side. There's a lot of people blowing up the value in joint ventures. And a bit of a joke that I sometimes say when I'm on stage is, so we've got Fred here, who's got no experience, no money, no time, right? And Jane, she's got no experience, no money, and no time. And the presenter on the stage, the guru in inverted commas, the guru says, if you guys just joint venture, you'll be amazing. The synergy will be incredible. Go do it. Come do my course and go joint venture. And it's like, that's ridiculous. It's just like you've got two people that are really going to struggle on their own. And now they've got to try and get two heads on the same page and communicate and blah, blah, blah. So a lot of people are wanting to joint venture. They're wanting to bring investor money in, and let's just simplify it. Let's call it, instead of a 100 unit block, call it a 5-bedroom HMO, house of multiple occupancy. So 5 sharers, you know, your friend scenario from TV, and call it a 200 grand house where, yes, you need a 25% deposit, 50K down. So someone's bringing the investor in, and they've got the vendor, and the vendor's happy to sell at a decent price. Maybe they're happy to sell. Maybe it's worth 250 and they can pick it up for 200, let's say. How, on your big deals, and 100, 200 units is certainly a big deal, how are you making your money? Are you taking a slice, 5%, 10% of the deal? Mm-hmm. Are you charging everyone a fee? Are you doing both? Because I think there's a lot of superficial excitement about collaborations, and I think you said the word syndication, but very little hard advice on, so how do you actually make your money? And I'd love to know, A, how you do it on that HMO that I've just described, and B, how would you do it in a big deal? How do you do it on a big deal?
Joint venture is slightly different to a syndication. Our investors in a syndication, a joint venture really indicates that everyone has a say, right? Mm. All parties have a say. You know, syndication, we are what we call the general partner, so we're the GP. And then we have the LP, which are the limited partners. And they have a vote. They do have some say, but they're not the experts, right? It's not. It's like you're investing in us as professionals because that's what we do.
Gotcha.
And so talk about the value here. So typically, think of a 100% pie, right? The deal is owned 100% by an entity. And that entity, we all buy shares in. I buy shares in it. My investors buy shares in it. And investors, or the limited partners, they own typically 70% of the entire deal. We as the GP, for putting the deal together, for finding the finance, for finding it, for brokering it, you know, getting it all there, we own 30% of the deal. We have typically a hurdle, which means that investors will only get paid first before us. And so anytime cash flow comes in, investors will get what's called a preferred return. So it might be, say, 7% of their money. They'll get an IOU. So cash flow comes in, cash flow comes in, cash flow comes in. They get paid whatever the cash flow is. It might not hit the 7% hurdle. Well, we'll just accrue that over time. And then when we sell, we'll catch you up. And then whatever profits, we'll pay back your initial investment. And then whatever profits left over, we'll split it 70-30. And so investors in our syndications, we make money. We make a bit of a closing fee for pulling the deal together. And we really don't make any money until we sell the deal in 3 to 5 years' time. In terms of your fees and how we make money, it's we get money, a bit of money on the front end and money essentially on the back end, and then investors make all the cash flow. But then when we have a new asset or, you know, an improved value asset in the future, we all get to participate in it after certain hurdles are met. Mm. So does that answer the question?
It does. I've got some follow-up questions, if I may.
Sure.
Give us some numbers. What would a 100-unit building, what would you be buying that for?
In today's market, you're probably looking at around, let's just keep it simple. It's probably not this, but let's keep it simple. So 100 units, probably $100,000. You're looking to buy for $10 million. We are raising between probably $3 to $4 million of down payment, closing costs, and some portion of the capital expenditure. So, you know, your ultimate all-in value will probably be around the $12 million because you're adding your CapEx in there. But out of that, we're going to get financing. Typically, it's 70 to 75% of the value of what we, or the overall what's called loan to cost. And so you're probably getting a $7 to $7.5 million loan. The investors aren't getting that loan. We as a GP are qualifying for that loan. We have to have a net worth. We have to have liquidity. We have to have experience. And none of the partners or the limited partners take any exposure on that loan. And it's all non-recourse and stuff like that. So that's typically how we structure, say, about a $10 million loan, $3 to $4 million of raising equity. The rest is financed. And we split that up, you know, between down payments and capital expenditure and all that sort of stuff. And then we go off and we execute.
Okay. So they have no liability other than the cash they've put in, presumably.
Correct.
Do you give personal guarantees on the whole deal or not?
No. Right. I wouldn't. Personal guarantees, it's investing in real estate. Like, we only invest with people who are sophisticated investors. So hence the name of your podcast. It is that we only invest with people who understand the asset. And it's our job as general partners to go out in the community and try and educate people to become sophisticated investors so they can understand it.
Forgive me, Reid. I understand your investors won't get a personal guarantee from you, but will your finance providers for the 70-75% loan?
Yeah, so we have non-recourse and we have these things called bad boy carve-outs. So yes, I as a personal human being, I have a net worth and a liquidity and experience, and I will sign on the dotted line. But it is if the deal goes bad for some reason, they will not come after me personally. If it's just out of my control and I can't do anything about it, like the 2008 hits or COVID hits again, then they've got to come back and take back the deal, then they can't come after me personally because it's non-recourse. However, if I do something fraudulent, you know, they're called the bad boy carve-outs. You know, I take the money and do something stupid with it, then it becomes recourse at that point.
Okay, fascinating. I said on your podcast that the US market is so much more favorable. I have yet to achieve an institutional loan that didn't insist on a personal guarantee. That's like how archaic we are here. So, and that's no fault. You know, if the market plummets, tough. We want it from you. Don't care why you're on the dotted line. To the extent they want independent legal advice so that you can't wriggle out of it or anything. So, yeah, it is fascinating. So You mentioned 7%. Are you talking about 7% return on investment for your investors per annum? Is that?
That's ballpark. Yes, that's correct.
That's what they're aiming for. You're aiming for, but no penalties if you don't achieve that. It just, you know, if you achieve half that, the other half rolls up till the end. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, that's the again, just a really a pref return, preferred return. If you think of the capital stack, you've got the debt wants to get paid first, right? Mm. And then you have, you know, this accruing. It's not a note, but it's just like, hey, we've got this IOU to investors, and you get the first X percent of cash flow. That X percent happens to be 7%. But sometimes deals don't cash flow that well out of the gate, and it needs to. You know, we need to do our business plan and get the asset performing. Think of it like a machine. We've got to get well oiled and get it performing. And then we just anything that we don't hit in the years, like maybe year one, you might only get 3% cash flow. Year two might be 4%. Year three might be 5%. Those deltas in all those first 3 years, we'll just accrue. And then when we come to sell, we'll say, hey, investors, here's your initial principal back. We also owe you, you know, X percent because we need to catch up on the pref. And then there'll be some proceeds left over that we're all going to share 70-30. Okay.
So long as the investment performs, they are guaranteed the 7% plus a share, a 70% share of the profit. That makes sense. So let's stick with the 10 million deal. Mm-hmm. What kind of fees would you be taking out of that? So I think you said... Sure. 12 million perhaps total costs, 11, 12 million total costs. What are you looking at up front?
Typically, we do a 2% acquisition fee of what the property is worth. So that, you know, so on a $10 million deal, it'd be about $200,000. That's paid out to the general partnerships, and that's split with whoever's in that GP, myself, my business partners, some other people who might come on board to help either raise money or, you know, do other activities in the deal. And then as we hold the deal, there'll be, you know, asset management fees, which is very, very small. They're about 1.5% on revenue from the property. And that's, you know, that really just keeps the lights on. It's not on a $10 million deal. You might be making $40,000 or $50,000 a year. Again, I ain't getting rich off that. It's just, it's just something to sort of compensate us for not doing work for free. And that's typically it, you know, and then you sort of hold through the life of the asset, and then, you know, we exit. There's some other people out there who do more. They have, you know, exit fees and all this other stuff, but we're pretty stock standard, just 2% on the front end, 1% or 2% asset management fees, and then, you know, we get a 30% on the back end.
And so, $1 million question, or the $10 million question: what would you be looking to sell this asset for, this hypothetical one?
Well, I didn't even need to have a hypothetical. So I can tell you literally my first ever syndication deal, I bought it for $16.1 million back in 2016, and we've just gone under contract for $28.25 million. And we're in year five now, so we're in the fifth year, which is what we told investors. So that gives you some indication of how much we've been able to grow. So what's that over? You're looking at about a 50% growth or more in value over a five-year period. So a $10 million deal, I'd probably $10-12 million deal, you're probably looking to try and sell that for $17-18 million in 5 years' time. That's a typical rule of thumb.
And so your slice, just working out your slice on that, is $3-4 million, something like that. Is that right?
To the GP, that's right. And then we split up between all the partners involved. So, yep.
So if we roll that back to the little 200 grand house, what numbers would you put in there if someone's trying to do that with a single investor then?
Single investor. It depends. If I'm just spitballing in the back of a napkin here, obviously with the bigger stuff, you have the bigger the pie, the more pie goes around. Like the smaller the pie, there's less to go around. So it really comes down to roles and responsibilities. I think, you know, on a JV, if you're truly bringing the deal to the table, you're bringing debt to the table. You're bringing, you know, you bring the deal, you bring the debt. And you really just then the investor can come on, one investor, then maybe a little bit more advantageous to yourself. Maybe a 50-50 might be a little better because you've done all the hard work on these bigger deals. It's just the scale is just different. So on a smaller deal like $200,000, you know, if you're looking at, what is it, 20% down, you know, looking at 40 Gs, but you've done all that, you've found the plot, you've found it, you've negotiated, you've done all the stuff, you know, you brought the debt to the table, like, That deserves something. So, you know, I would think in the range of about 50% of, and again, you could have fees on top of that as well if you wanted to. But that would be probably very fair and reasonable, I would think, if I was an investor, if I did nothing. I literally bought my 40 Gs at the table. I was like, oh, this is going to be a great deal. And I'm going to get a great return on investment. Because the other thing you got to realize, Frank, is that I project my return. So I talk about the 7% of my deals and then we have the back end fees. It will come out to some sort of mid-teen IRR. You know, if I put in $100,000, we're trying to 1.8 to double people's monies in five to seven years. Hmm. That's a really good return to investors, right? Anything above that that gets paid out to GPs, like it's kind of irrelevant because the investor's return is making such good money and they're not lifting a finger. So it's also how you structure. You could structure that little deal 70-30 to you because you found it, right? And when the investor only gets 30%, if he's still making double-digit money, what does it matter what you make? You know what I mean? Yeah. So like there's also an angle at which you've got to come at it to know, well, what are they currently getting paid on their money? Probably not that great sitting in the bank. Mm-hmm. And that's you can back into what they want to get. And if that's if you come up to a and you've got to be transparent about what you're going to make, but if the numbers make sense for them and it's in the double digits, then and you take 50% of the back end, then I don't see why you couldn't structure it that way. And that's the beauty of real estate investing, right? You can structure it any way you want. Absolutely. As long as you understand the needs of both parties.
Mm. Absolutely, Reid. I couldn't agree more. On your podcast, and if guys listening to this, you want to check out Reid's podcast, we'll give you the details at the end of the show. But on that, I talked about how I was started off sourcing deals for investors, charging £1,000 per deal. And I just gave them the whole thing. And it was like no money left in after about 4 or 6 months. And they were making money for decades afterwards. And I walked away with £1,000, like skipping down the street because I was over the moon. But I was coming from the perspective of being a very young teacher earning, you know, £1,400 a month. So a grand was like, wow, I've just earned 3 weeks' money. But very quickly turned that into 20, 25 grand a deal from exactly what you're talking about, changing that perspective and looking at, hang on, look at what they're getting. I don't have to give them everything. I can actually take a fair share for myself. It's an interesting way of looking at it. And I think for those of you listening, that principle of charging money up front, charging a fair amount of money out of the cash flow throughout, and then having a nice payday at the end is a really good principle to take from Reid's model on any deal that you do, any JV or any sourcing that you do for an investor. So thanks for that, Reid. Appreciate it.
I'll just back that up by saying, yeah, it's understanding, and I think I didn't mention this again, that the value of what you're bringing is a service, right? You're bringing a service to someone who doesn't have the time or the energy to go out and find, and I call it cracking deals. I love cracking deals. It's my Australian slang, right? and that deserves a fee, right? That's not, you're not doing work for free, because to get to that one deal, you might have gone through 100, right? And that's taken time and effort and energy and relationships. And so the same thing applies just on my end, but it's in bigger scale. So I might not be doing 25 deals a year. I might be doing only 5 deals a year, but they're really, really big. And to get to those 5 deals, I've still got to get through 50, 60 deals myself. So it's the same numbers. It's just on different scales.
I'd like to talk a bit about your perspective on investors. So I'm sure you come across novice investors, you come across traditional investors that have got a bit of investing behind them, but are pretty basic in their approach. And, you know, you and your business partners are clearly playing at a sophisticated level. What advice would you have to people at each of those levels, Reid? What would you say to them if they said, look, I just want to play in the next league above? What would you say to those three different categories of investor?
Yeah, so let's start with the first one, right? The basic one. Well, first thing, I've been there. You've been there. We've all been there. We start from zero. Everyone starts from zero. So don't think that you need to get there tomorrow, because it won't happen tomorrow. The analogy I gave earlier, I picked up Rich Dad Poor Dad. It took me over nearly 8 years to leave my day job. So having the mindset that this is you're in it for the long term will help you set yourself up for success, because I see so many people giving up, thinking that, oh God, I'm going to go get rich and quit my J job in a year. And they get to the end of that year and they're like, oh, I haven't got to that point. And they're like, oh, screw this. Real estate's not for me. And it didn't work. You know, stuff it. Having the long-term mindset is super important when you get started. The second thing when you get started is education. Education, education, education. You have to go out and educate yourself, listening to podcasts, reading books. And then the next biggest thing is action. So many people do the first two things. They get the good mindset. They take the courses, but they never do anything. They sit on the sidelines because it makes them feel good and they're in their comfort zone. you have to get comfortable being uncomfortable and pushing those boundaries. And that will help you then start pushing the ball down the fairway towards your financial goals. So that's the first group of people we're going to put, we'll call them the newbies, but you need that action-taking step because action will then lead you to your first deal. Like my first deal, I don't get to deal number 10 without doing deal number one. Well, then once you've got deal number one, deal number two under your belt, then you're in that sort of medium category, right? You've done it a few times. And for me, I started out just all self-education. And I didn't then go get a mentor until I was about three deals in. And a mentor is very, very important because being an entrepreneur, being in this space, whatever you do, whether it's real estate or you're building a business, you need to surround yourself with people you aspire to be. If you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. Getting that mentor is really, really important. And I had to pay for my mentor when I first got started, but he was someone who was ahead of me and I wanted to be like him. And what that does by going out and getting a mentor really solidifies the fact that, and I had to pay for my mentor again, but I paid for it and that meant I was taking a bet on myself. I'm worth taking my life to the next level and I'm going to use this person's advice and whatever they charge to help me along that way. Now, there's a lot of mentors out there that will rip you off and don't teach you anything. But for me, I was very strategic about finding that right mentor in the fact that I know that I didn't spend a ton of money, but I spent enough money to take it seriously. And that was enabling me to be a better athlete in the sense of being an entrepreneur. Like you think of Kobe Bryant or Michael Jordan, they all had great coaches. The coaches themselves may not be the best athletes themselves, but they're there to be a sounding board. So they're the middle group of people. And then once you get into the more sophisticated, and you're probably already graduating to sophistication at that stage, but once you get into where I am today, well, there's always bigger things that I need to strive for. And I have business coaches and mentors now that are different to what I did back in the day, but it's in and around being more a better CEO, a better leader, a better husband. I've figured out the business of real estate. It's now about maximizing my business ecosystem to help my investors. It's about building a legacy for myself. It's about building, good brands and things that are going to be around for decades to come, but also being self-aware and enjoying the journey along the way. So there's different elements and different stages in life. And that's what I love about building businesses is that you start from the beginning and you slowly put one step in front of the other. And all of a sudden you pull your head up in 10 years time. You're like, wow, look where I've come from. That was a bit of a long-winded answer, but hopefully that I hit all three of them for you there, Frank.
You did, mate. You did. And really sage advice, very sage advice. I am never without a mentor and sometimes I've have more than one. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that's helped me on my journey for sure. And it's been expensive at times and painfully expensive. You seem to have got low prices, but I have paid through the nose for some of my mentors, like probably more than I could afford. And then you do a deal that you never could have done without that mentor. And it becomes insignificant in cost. And yeah, I think that really wise advice. I want to comment on something. And those of you that are listening, I meet a lot of people in the course of investing, in the course of networking, in the course of interviewing people for the podcast. I can distinguish those that are going to be successful from those that are not from a few, very few traits, actually. And I reckon, had I met you, Reed, when you were going from boat to boat, maybe not that early, but going from boat to boat, going, have you got day work? Or certainly going from structural engineering firm or building firm to building firm, asking, have you got any work for me as a structural engineer? That ability, and those of you listening that haven't yet taken the leap, and Reed sums it up perfectly there. You can do all the education, but if you don't actually do anything with it, you're not going to get any results. And Brad Sugars, founder of Action Coach, actually has an equation for this. And his equation, whether or not he invented it, but I learned it from him, so I'll give him credit. It's B, so the person that you are, times do, the action that you take, equals have, which is your results. And if you think about that equation, you can know every sophisticated property investing strategy under the sun. But if you actually don't get your backside off the sofa, your results are going to be zero. And similarly, you can be running 12 hours a day, knocking on doors, trying to do deals, meeting with realtors, meeting with estate agents, etc. But if you haven't got the knowledge behind you, your results are going to be really poor. And what's jumped out at me, Reid, was you were comfortable, A, taking massive action, and B, getting loads of no's. And if I'd met you at that point, if we'd had a beer in the bar and you're in New York or whatever, and you were describing your daily activity, I would have put money on you succeeding. And clearly you have. It's easy to say now. But the people that I meet that are taking action are typically the ones, especially if it's massive action, are typically the ones that then go on to get the results. Because as I said in my interview on your podcast, if you throw enough mud at the wall, some of it sticks, and then you can start building a business around it. So thank you for sharing that. So I want to finish off with my last couple of questions on what have you seen? So you come into contact with loads of investors. You've just described, you know, a positive journey from novice to sophisticated investor. What mistakes have you seen investors make that have held them back in your experience? Because I think we can learn a lot from negative example.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think like early on, and again, I don't want to come across as being, this has all been roses and cherries. It hasn't.
It never is. Yeah.
It's like my first deal, and I'll say this out loud, it was a Section 8 housing. Section 8 in the States is voucher housing. It was a drive-by shooting on my first property. No one was hurt, thank God, but it was a very eye-opening. I didn't make a ton of money on my first deal, but it got me in the game. My first fix and flip deal, I lost money because I had my first outside investor, which was my dad, and was my third deal in. I'd done two little small duplexes, and it was a flip, fixing, flipping, and I had to make him whole, and I had to come out of pocket to do that. And even with my experience in structural engineering, I still... The GC stole a bunch of stuff, and we're not going to get into it. But that could have stopped me. I could have said, "Oh, that's enough." Hmm. That's, you know, I could have stopped there. And I'm going to give up. This is rubbish. Having the ability to know and be crystal clear on where you want to go, because ultimately there will be failures. Do not, if you're still listening to this and you think you're just going to go straight to the moon, you're wrong. There will be failures. And once you become okay with the fact that there's going to be failures and how to manage those failures, then you will be able to take that action. Because like for me moving halfway across the world, I was scared. I'm not going to swear. I'm almost scared the S-H-I-T word. And that was a really big challenge for me mentally. Then when I started doing deals, that was another big challenge for me. But I was constantly pushing my boundaries and getting comfortable being uncomfortable. And I didn't have all the answers, right? And so many people don't take the action because they don't have the answers. That's okay. But sit down with that fear and really play it out. Okay, the fear of me moving halfway across the world. Okay, I think about it. I don't get a job. I spend 3 months in New York and I move back to Australia. That's the worst case scenario. Oh, it's not too bad, is it?
Right? America kicks you out, yeah.
America kicks me out, right? getting my first deal. Well, it's my first. It's my money. I've saved it. I've educated. If I lose it all, it's my money, and I've still got my day job, and I'll fight another day. It's $30,000, and then I'm not trying to say $30,000 is a lot of money, but it's also not, you know, it was I think a third of my salary at the time. So those little questions and comments you say to yourself when you're understanding the risk of taking that action or not to take that action will also look at it in a different light, because then you will stop worrying about it, because you can then say, look, I am worth this. I know I can do this. And I've already sort of gone through the uncomfortable outcomes, and I'm okay making progress forward. The other thing that really drives me, Frank, and I'll say, and hopefully you hear this from me, is the fear of regret. I am very driven as a human being by fear of regret. If I remember moving to the United States saying, if I don't make it here, whatever that looks like, if I don't get a job and I move back, I'll have my tail between my legs. I'll feel pretty down, but at least I gave it a go. And that's the biggest thing in my life, is that will my 65-year-old self judge me for making the decision that I make today at 35 or 25 or whatever it was? And 9 times out of 10, the answer is no. So start asking yourself, what is your 65-year-old self going to look back and say, I took a risk and I'm happy. I'm happy that I take that risk. Even if I was to fail, I still took the risk and I'm here to fight another day. Now, you've got – there's a lot in that to unpack. You've got to understand the risk. You've got to, you know, be educated before you do it. But that action-taking step, that mindset, getting you into that mindset, ask your 65-year-old self if they'll take that next step. Or will they look back on you and say, God, I wish I'd taken that step? Because for me, I'm sitting here today. I had no idea I'd move to this country and do what I've done. And I know that the last 10 years, as Tony Robbins says, they say, you overestimate what you can achieve in a year, but you underestimate what you can achieve in a decade. So now I'm 35. At 45, I really don't have any. I've got some targets, but I know I'm going to have a freaking awesome time because the last 10 years have been absolutely insane. So I'll end at that.
I like it. He's now gone on to say, Tony Robbins now has gone on to say, and you massively underestimate what you can do in four decades, because he's been teaching personal development for 40 years now, which is unbelievable. I don't know anyone who's got that longevity behind him. But yeah, impressive, very impressive. Thanks for that, Reid. There's so much in that. I've heard from so many different people that you rarely regret the things you do, but you often regret the things that you don't do. And I think that's so, so true.
Thank you.
Yes, mate.
Oh, sorry. So, did that come through?
Yeah. Was that your dog? You shouting at your dog? Yeah. I could hear him in the background.
I thought he was on mute. My apologies.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I could hear you shuffling. I was thinking, that's all right. The editor would take that out. But I think we'll leave it in. Pete, leave it in. That'd be funny.
Yelling at the dog.
Yeah. But it's funny that he's called Hank. I thought you shouting me. I thought you said, because my missus calls me Hank.
does she?
Yeah, that's funny.
That's hilarious. No, the dog's actually called Hank.
How do you know my wife's nickname for me? Hey, Reid, it's been brilliant having you on the podcast. Loads of insights into the US market, how you've got to where you're at now. And I just want to share that with the listeners. So you did your first deal in 2012. Am I right in saying that?
That's correct. Yes.
That's 9 years ago. And how old are you today?
35.
So by the age of 35, you've only been investing since 26. I started at 26, funnily enough. I'm 39, so I'm a few years older than you. You've got 3,000 units under your belt and are rocking and rolling. And if that's not encouragement to anyone sat there, if you're in your 20s, our youngest franchisee is 23, or if you're in your 60s, I think our oldest franchisee currently is 64, it makes no odds. As Reid says, you can start that new chapter in your life, start that new trajectory for you so quickly, and it transforms next year, it transforms the next 5 years, and certainly in the next decade. Reid, it's been brilliant having you on, sir. How can our listeners get in touch? How can they follow you? How can they support you?
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for asking. Easiest way is to go to reedgoossens.com. That's reedgoossens.com. You'll find the books. You'll find my podcast on there. I'm pretty active on Instagram. So reedgoossens on Instagram. You can also hit me up on LinkedIn. And if anyone is ever coming through LA, you're getting after this COVID is over and you're getting back on planes and you want to come through Los Angeles and you check out the Hollywood sign, hit me up and we can go talk some shop. And you can do that at info@reedgoossens.com.
Cheers, Reid. I may well do that, mate. I've promised my kids, because we were in lockdown here for months and months. I don't know if you know, the kids are off school for pretty much a year. And I promised them a road trip across America to like get some space. So if the US starts letting us in, I don't think we're allowed in yet. But if they do, then I'll give you a shout, mate. That'd be good.
Awesome. Let's do it.
Thank you so much, Reid. Thanks for joining us. And for those of you listening, I'll see you next time. Until then, happy investing.
Sophisticated Property Investing, a podcast brought to you by Ethical Property Partners, the experts in sophisticated property investment.